From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, the third-party debate.
The solution to a bad, corrupt government is not no government, it's good government.
Countries in deep doo-doo.
Jill Stein is the Green Party's nominee for president. Gary Johnson is the Libertarian Party's, and we've invited them to face off. Also, how a short vacation turned into a year-long immigration nightmare.
And the United States is the only home in the country, you know, and I don't have any other place to go. I really don't.
Trapped in American Samoa. Also, a conversation with Colin Malloy of the Decemberists about his new children's novel and the story behind a new dinosaur discovered this week. Plus, the legendary Carol Burnett.
People come up and say to me, it was appointment television.
And later, new music from Neil Godrich, the super producer for the band Radiohead.
I'm the luckiest fan in the world because I get to sit in the same room as them.
That's all in this episode of Weekends and All Things Considered. Here's what it's like to be a third-party candidate running for president.
You're excluded from the debates. You spend an exhausting amount of time until Labor Day just trying to get over the ballot access barriers. Your petitioners are harassed in the streets. You're subjected to baseless lawsuits by one party or another.
That's Ralph Nader. He's run for president three times, four if you count the time he ran unofficially. In 2000, he managed to win almost 3% of the national vote. And that year, he tried to get in on a debate between George W. Bush and Al Gore.
Well, I went to Northeastern University in Boston, where one of the debates was going on, and I had a ticket to go to an adjoining building right next to the building that had the debate going on, and I was almost arrested.
And to this day, try getting a third-party candidate into a debate, and, well, it's practically impossible. The Commission on Presidential Debate says to be included, you have to poll 15% with voters, which is why George Farah, the founder of Open Debate, it's a group that wants the system reformed, it's why he thinks the commission is the main problem.
And this commission exists for the principal purpose of protecting and strengthening the two parties. And every 4 years, they allow the candidates, the major party candidates, to negotiate agreements that dictate many of the terms of the debates, including the exclusion of popular third-party voices.
So given that the two major party candidates had 90 minutes and at least 50 million viewers on Wednesday night, we decided to invite two of the third party candidates to an NPR debate. That's our cover story, the NPR third party candidate debate, so cue the music. Tonight, Weekends and All Things Considered brings you the third-party debate. Two candidates vying for the White House will battle it out to win a piece of the electorate. Gary Johnson is the Libertarian Party's nominee. Jill Stein is the Green Party's. And we even have some canned applause. And now, let the debate begin. Gary Johnson is in Cincinnati, Ohio. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And welcome also to Jill Stein in Houston, Texas.
Great to be with you, Guy.
Okay, Gary Johnson, Jill Stein, you both know the rules. We're going to focus on domestic issues, the economy, healthcare, and the role of government. And I'm going to be keeping you to the time allotted for each answer. So, Gary Johnson, you have 30 seconds to make an opening statement. Go.
Countries in deep doo-doo. Let's stop the growing police state. Let's stop our military interventions. Let's balance the federal budget. Let's eliminate income tax, corporate tax. Let's abolish the IRS, replace all that with one federal consumption tax. That will create tens of millions of jobs in a zero corporate tax rate environment.
Jill
Stein. How much time did I have to spare? Just to give me a sense.
You actually have 5-6 seconds left.
Oh, shoot. Okay, I won't make that mistake. Thank you.
Jill Stein, you have 30 seconds to make your case.
Well, we are in crisis. We're losing our jobs, decent wages, our homes, affordable health care and higher education. Civil liberties are under attack, and the climate's in meltdown. The wealthy few are doing better than ever, and the political establishment's making it worse, imposing austerity on everyday people while they squander trillions on wars, Wall Street bailouts, and tax breaks for the wealthy. A vote for me is a vote for the solutions that we need, for jobs, not corporate tax breaks, for health care as a human right, public higher education that's free, ending student debt, and downsizing the military to pay for it.
All right, great. Let's start with the economy. Jill Stein, you're going to go first, and you will have 45 seconds. What is your plan to jumpstart the U.S. economy? And please be as specific as possible.
Great. Well, the economy is working great if you're a hedge fund manager or a big CEO or a bank, but it's not working for everyday people. So we need to first and foremost create jobs. We're calling for a Green New Deal that will create 25 million jobs, that will jumpstart a green economy and put an end to unemployment, and that will call a halt to climate change and make wars for oil obsolete because we'll have a green economy.
Gary Johnson, your plan?
I think we need to balance the federal budget immediately, or we're going to find ourselves in the midst of a monetary collapse. So I am promising to submit a balanced budget to Congress in the year 2013, which is a $1.4 trillion reduction in federal spending. And that would include the entitlements, Medicaid, Medicare, military spending. I would eliminate income tax, corporate tax. I would abolish the IRS. I would replace all of that with one federal consumption tax, the fair tax. I think that's the answer when it comes to American jobs, because in a zero corporate tax rate environment, if the private sector doesn't create tens of millions of jobs, I don't know what it takes to create tens of millions of jobs. It's also the answer when it comes to our exports. With China, for example, we're going to bleed out all existing federal tax. That's what will make us competitive.
We've reached 30 seconds. Let's move on to the topic of health care. Jill Stein, you are a medical doctor. What would a Stein administration's health care plan look like?
We need to simply bring the eligibility age for Medicare down to zero, in fact, pre-zero, from the moment of conception, so that people would be covered throughout life and from the very beginning of pregnancy. Because in doing that, we can cover everyone comprehensively, including your teeth and your ears and your eyes and your pharmaceuticals and your mental health and your reproductive health and all those things that get chopped out. We can cover it all and still save trillions of dollars over the coming decade, because a Medicare for All plan actually reduces the incredible, massive, wasteful private health insurance bureaucracy, puts all our health care dollars into health care, okay, and it reduces that inflation that's driving up the cost.
All right. Gary Johnson, would a President Johnson repeal Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act? And if so, what is your plan to insure uninsured Americans?
Well, first of all, I would not have insurance to cover myself for ongoing medical need if we had a genuine free market approach to health care. And by the way, health care in this country is about as far removed from free market as it possibly could be. But I would have insurance to cover myself for catastrophic injury and illness, and I would pay as you go in a system that was absolutely competitive. What about government embarking on the notion of doubling the number of doctors as opposed to restricting all the choices that we have? This is what's leading to high costs and the fact that we don't have a whole bunch of choices when a whole bunch of choices could exist.
So you would repeal Obamacare?
That, and I would also repeal the Republicans' Medicaid Part D, prescription health care benefits. Look, the alternative to not reining in these costs is we're going to suffer a monetary collapse. And a monetary collapse is when the money that we have doesn't buy a thing because of the accompanying inflation that is going to go along with borrowing and printing money to the to the tune of 43 cents out of every dollar we're spending.
Okay, Jill Stein, your rebuttal?
Well, we have plenty of examples, fortunately, of where Medicare for All, which is essentially the system, a single-payer insurance system that's used in practically every developed country around the world, they are providing health care at half the cost per person, yet they are getting far better health outcomes. People are living longer, they're less sick, and lower infant mortality. So instead of trying to invent a system that hasn't been found to work yet through a free-for-all health care system, there is no such thing as a free market in health care, and the U.S. sort of comes as close as any to it, and it's complete chaos here. Let's use the example of what's working. Medicare is working, and in fact, to really save money, we want to have not just a sick care system, is what we have right now, but a real health care system by implementing prevention and an infrastructure for health at the level of our communities.
All right, and that's time for you. Finally, the role of government for the both of you. Let me begin with Gary Johnson. What role do you believe the government has in ensuring the well-being of Americans?
Government has a role to protect us against individuals, groups, corporations that would do us harm. Government has a role to protect us against foreign countries that would attack this country. But I use the notion of under attack. We continually militarily intervene, and as a result of that, we have hundreds of millions of enemies to this country that, but for these military interventions, would otherwise not exist.
Jill Stein, should government be making investments in infrastructure in this country?
Yes, we should. We need to use what has worked before, and we've been in an economic crisis before in the Great Depression, and one of the ways we came out was through the New Deal, which went a long way to get the economy back on its feet. I think we're in trouble now, and the role of government, I think, is to help us, to help we the people. We need a government of, by, and for the people, not of, by, and for the corporations. There's way too much corporations running the show in government, but the solution to a bad, corrupt government is not no government, it's good government.
Time now for closing remarks. Both of you have 30 seconds each. Gary Johnson, for those uncommitted to either President Obama or Mitt Romney, why should they vote for you?
Whether you vote for Mitt Romney or Barack Obama, I'm going to offer up a couple of predictions. One is we're going to continue to have a heightened police state in this country. The other is that we're going to find ourselves in a continued state of military intervention. We are at continuous war with everyone. And then lastly, we're going to find ourselves, regardless of which one of these two guys gets elected, we're going to find ourselves continuing to borrow and spend money in ways that are absolutely unsustainable. And if we don't get control of this, we are going to collapse as a country. We are not immune from the mathematics of continuing to borrow and print money to the tune of 43 cents out of every dollar we spend.
Okay. Jill Stein, why should Americans make you President Stein?
Well, I agree with Gary that we are really headed in the wrong direction. In fact, we're accelerating in the wrong direction under both parties. And in fact, Barack Obama has basically embraced most of the key policies of George Bush on the bailouts for Wall Street, the layoffs for Main Street, the expanding free trade agreements that offshore our jobs and undermine wages at home, the expanding wars, attack on our civil liberties, drill baby drill on the climate, you name it. We're going in the wrong direction. We need a president. We need a political party that is of, by, and for the people. If you go into the voting booth and you cast a vote for either Wall Street-sponsored candidate, you are giving them a mandate for four more years of the same.
And that is all the time we have. Thank you to our candidates, Gary Johnson, the Libertarian Party's nominee for president, and thanks also to Jill Stein, the Green Party's candidate for president. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, guys.
Thank you
good
so
job.
Much.
This next one is about being from somewhere that no longer exists and having nowhere to go. 39-year-old Mikhail Sebastian was born in the former Soviet Union, but when the USSR broke up in the early 1990s, the place he lived became the independent state of Azerbaijan. Now, Sebastian is an ethnic Armenian, and so the Azeris refused to grant him citizenship. But when he tried to move to neighboring Armenia, the Armenians wouldn't allow it because he couldn't prove he was Armenian. For starters, he doesn't speak the language, and he knows little about the culture. So in 1995, Mikhail Sebastian took his Soviet passport, which was irrelevant by then, and he managed to fly to the United States on a temporary business visa. He overstayed that visa and was eventually detained by immigration officials.
When they released me in February 2003, they told me that we know that you're stateless and there is no country in the world that will be able to take you. So basically, you will be allowed to live in the United States in limbo. We're going to give you permission to work.
So Mikhail built a life here. He took some college courses and found a job as a barista in L.A. The condition was simple. If he left the U.S., he wouldn't be allowed back in. Now, the thing is, Mikhail Sebastian loves to travel. So he went to Hawaii, Alaska, and U.S. territories like Puerto Rico and Guam. No problem. Until he decided to take a short trip last December.
And I was thinking about other places within the United States that I never explored before. And it came up to American Samoa. And I was like, okay, this island belongs to the United States, and I will make this trip. And I went to Los Angeles Immigration Office, and I asked them if I will be able to go to American Samoa. And the guy checked my documents, and he said that you're okay to go.
But it actually wasn't okay. When Mikhail tried to board his flight home to L.A. from American Samoa, Immigration and Customs Enforcement said American Samoa has its own immigration system, and by going there, Mikhail Sebastian had self-deported. That was 10 months ago, and Mikhail is still there. He's forbidden from finding work, and he's desperately trying to figure out a way back.
It's tough. I'm really mentally, I'm getting crazy here. But I'm very thankful to the local government of American Samoa. They accommodated me with the local Samoan family in one of the village here, and they do provide me $50 a week allowance so I can buy something. But also I'm very thankful to the owner of the house I'm staying.
And what do you do all day?
I come to McDonald's every day from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. because that's the only place I can use the Wi-Fi and to connect with my friends and to ask for the help to communicate with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees that on my side and working with me. But I cannot be outside because I am very a temperature sensitive person, and the climate here, tropical humidity, is just kind of killing me.
Do you have any sense of when or whether, in fact, you will ever be allowed to return to the U.S.?
I hope that the situation will be resolved because I lived 16 years in the United States, and United States is the only home and country I know, and I don't have any other place to go. I really don't. My job, my friends, I started there. I integrated within American society and assimilated, and I don't have any other consulate or embassy to turn around and look for protection who will be able to advocate on my behalf but the United States.
That's Mikhail Sebastian. He's a stateless man. He's been stranded in American Samoa. Mikhail Sebastian, thank you for sharing your story. Good luck, and we hope it gets resolved soon.
Thank you so much, Guy. Thanks a lot.
It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
We'll win Virginia again. We'll finish what we started.
We're going to get America back and keep it so strong that the world is going to wonder at the great things we've achieved. Thank you so much.
President Obama and Mitt Romney both campaigning in Virginia yesterday. New tracking polls out today show a post-debate bounce for Romney, who has closed the gap in Virginia and Ohio. James Fallows of The Atlantic joins us, as he does most Saturdays now, for a look beyond the headlines. Jim, good Saturday to you.
Hello, Guy.
Let's start with the NPR third-party debate that we just hosted. Gary Johnson and Jill Stein, both offering clear alternatives to President Obama and Mitt Romney. I wonder, Jim, if Wednesday's debate might have been a bit livelier with those two up on stage.
Oh, it sure would have been. And I think most people would have liked to have heard that range of proposals, whether it was critique of the permanent war policy of the United States or climate change emphasis or whatever. So, yes, I think most people would like to hear that. And technically, it might happen. For the last 12 years or so, the debate commission has said if a third-party candidate gets to 15% in national opinion polls, then they can join the debates, as Ross Perot did 20 years ago. Realistically, that's a very high barrier for a third-party candidate to meet. And also, realistically, the truth is the two major parties don't want to have the attention divided this way. One of the reasons why President Jimmy Carter, for whom I once worked, had only one debate with Ronald Reagan is that Carter simply refused to have a debate that included John Anderson, who was the third party candidate in that era.
Given the sort of the narrowness of the views, the absence of fact checking, I mean, the sort of canned nature of a lot of the responses, what value do the debates really have?
From any platonic sense, you'd have to be pretty depressed with this ritual. And yet, I think it actually is good for America. For one thing, it gets people's attention. Usually, during the entire course of 4 years, the public affairs event that gets the biggest American audience is the debates, especially the first one, even more than an inauguration, more than the conventions. And even if people aren't really being informed about the details of this or that policy, they do have some sense of the candidates, what they're like as people, how they react under stress. So I think that they are an imperfect vessel for public engagement.
Jim, lots of pundits, even political scientists, have been saying, you know, these debates don't matter, and this one will not matter. But then you look at the new tracking polls out today, taken after the debate. They show a significant bounce for Mitt Romney. So I wonder if those political scientists are wrong.
I certainly think they are. And certainly Governor Romney's performance was so much stronger and more focused and more engaged than the president's was this past week. It's no surprise if he is coming back. I'm sure from a political science point of view, it would be hard to prove that any one thing changed the presidential election because so many things go into them. But it just time and again over the years, you see these shifts in momentum and attention and sense of confidence and sense of support for one candidate or another based on on the results of a debate. I think we're seeing that right now.
The narrative this week was a Romney comeback, as he had a tough 2 or 3 weeks with a lot of bad media coverage. But then yesterday, the unemployment rate fell to its lowest level since January 2009, which, of course, is good news for the president. But I wonder, you know, whether these shifts in narratives ultimately matter at all.
Well, I think that they do have an effect. I mean, probably most voters have already made up their minds and did months ago about how they were going to vote in this election. They're weighing their own economic prospects. They're weighing war and peace around the world. They're weighing their sort of traditional loyalties to parties. They're weighing social issues, too. But in this final month of an election, people decide whether or not they're going to vote, whether they're going to try to enlist other people. So I think that just almost day by day for the month that's left, we're going to see changes in this narrative that will matter and should matter.
That's James Fallows. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic. You can find his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Guy.
Back in 1983, a young graduate student in paleontology named Paul Serino went to one of Harvard University's research museums to study a well-known fossil.
The professor there, Alfred Crompton, famously found a small dinosaur called Heterodontosaurus, which means different-toothed reptile. It had canines, it was a beautiful little skeleton, and that's what I came to worship. I came to study its bones. But what I found was something else.
Hidden among the shelves in a back room, Serino found blocks of red rock full of fossils that had never been studied.
This was the 1960s when he originally collected all these blocks of sandstone. They came to Harvard. One dinosaur was prepared, Heterodontosaurus. The other sat in a can.
So a few days later, Serino was talking to the man in charge of preparing fossils for examination. The man had been slowly going through those cans, dusting off ancient bones, and he showed Serino one slab of rock that seemed particularly interesting.
And on the slab were these tiny, just a little bit less than an inch long jaws with teeth and fangs, and it was a revelation. I looked at it, and immediately I knew I was looking at a new dinosaur. And that's where my story on this new dinosaur begins.
Okay, that was 30 years ago. And then what happened?
Well, you know, I photographed this new beast, drew it up, reconstructed it, but I ended up taking a detour. I thought I would find new specimens myself, and I headed down to Argentina to the earliest dinosaur beds where fragments of this kind of dinosaur had been found 30 years ago. And I struck gold there. I found lots of early dinosaurs. But this kind of dinosaur, the different-toothed dinosaur, eluded my team. And years passed, and I decided now was the time to release a very long study on this group, highlighted by a dinosaur I dubbed Pegomastax, thick jaw, because it has a very characteristic look, very short jaws, pretty much like a dinosaurian parrot.
Yeah, I'm looking at an artist's rendering of it, and it was like a snake, cat, parrot, chicken.
Snake, cat, parrot, porcupine. But what really catches you are the fangs. It looks like a bird with a parrot-like beak, but right behind that beak are fangs, both upper and lower.
Paul, we should mention before you describe it further that this was a 2-foot creature. This is like a cute little cat-sized dinosaur.
Yeah, none of them are beyond 3 feet. Pegomastax is under 2 feet. We're talking about a small house cat in terms of weight. It would have been covered by a bristle-like covering, making it perhaps less appetizing were another dinosaur to snarf it for lunch. And I think they were strict plant eaters.
If there was a dinosaur that you could domesticate, I think this would be the one.
I think so. There'd be a question. Now, they have a pretty good-sized brain, but I think the question would be, could you train it not to nip you, something we have to train our dogs? But I think you could probably get some average bird feed, and we don't know what it was eating exactly, but a very short snout and this plucking recurved beak, and then the slicing teeth. It's eating something hard, at least for part of its diet. It's probably picking at seeds. And so I think that, you'd be able to keep it around, and it probably would be trainable.
That's Paul Serino, a paleontologist, who this week identified a new dinosaur species called Pegomastax. You can see photos and drawings of that dinosaur at our website, npr.org. Paul Serino, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
On Saturday nights in 1973, if you were a fan of great television, you stayed home.
From Television City in Hollywood.
Our lineup on Saturday night was pretty incredible.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
It was All in the Family.
Songs that made the hit parade.
MASH. Mary Tyler Moore.
You might just make it after
long. Bob Newhart. And us.
The Us was the legendary Carol Burnett, who for 11 years on CBS was a capstone to those evenings of classic American TV. And now, she's offering fans a bit of the old glow of that living room television. A new DVD collection compiles 16 of Carol Burnett's favorite shows from her decade in prime time. I spoke with Carol Burnett this week about her favorite moments in the collection, about her career, and why The Carol Burnett Show is her proudest achievement.
People come up and, you know, say to me, it was appointment television. It reminds me of when I was with my family and my grandmother or my parents, and we would watch it. It does my heart good, let me say that, you know, to know that. And then we're on, a lot of our sketches are on YouTube, so now I'm getting mail from teenagers.
And so
even
great.
11 and 10-year-olds and stuff, you know.
Went with the Wind is one of the most famous sketches you ever did.
Yes.
About 20 minutes long. It's watching, it's like watching, almost like watching a Neil Simon play.
Oh, what am I going to do? Captain Butler is coming over and he's got money and I got to get it. And look at me. I look like the inside of a goat's stomach.
Well, that costume was Bob Mackie's idea, our costume designer.
Sis, help me take these down.
He designed everything everybody wore on every show, which sometimes would go up to maybe 65, 70 costumes a week.
Because I've got me a dress to make.
Yes.
And it was his idea to make the dress a curtain rod dress. Originally, it had been written that I would just fling the draperies over me and come down the stairs. But it was Bob's genius that came up with that.
Starlet. I love you. That gown is gorgeous.
Thank you. I saw it in the window and I just couldn't resist it.
One of the most amazing things about watching the show, even now, is the audience Q&A part.
Do you plan on making any more movies?
Yes, I have great plans to make movies. Yes, the producers don't have plans to call me, but I have great plans.
I mean, we're talking about a live show. It's improv right there. It's just always these amazing unscripted moments.
Right.
Did I ever go to acting school? Yes, I did. I took acting at UCLA, and then I went to Jeff Corey's class out here for a short while. Yeah.
Has it done any good, do you think?
I don't know.
There was one lady who wanted to sing.
I'd like to sing a song for the little lady from New York.
You want to sing, too?
And so I said, okay, come on up.
Come on up.
You know, and she was fearless. And the audience started to laugh, and she calmed them down. And I said, what's your name?
What's your name?
Terry McCann.
Terry, what do you want to sing?
And without even looking at me, she looked towards the band, and she said, you made me love you in the key of G.
You.
I mean, it was like she took over. And she started singing. The band was playing, and she was pretty good.
Yeah.
And she was wailing away. And I knew the song, so I joined in with her. And the audience is with us. Until the ride out of the tail end of the song, I knew it one way and she knew another.
Love you.
And she looked at me and she said, well, you screwed it up.
I'm sorry.
You can't write that stuff. I mean, it was just brilliant. I loved it.
I was speaking with the legendary comedian Carol Burnett. Her new DVD collection from Time Life is called The Carol Burnett Show, The Ultimate Collection. There's another amazing moment on this collection. It's a sketch called The Dentist with Harvey Korman and Tim Conway. Yeah. And I've got to ask you to tell the story of that sketch.
Well, it was written differently, and Harvey and Tim had rehearsed it.
Dr. Kiefer just graduated from dental school. As a matter of fact, you're his very first patient, so he may be a little nervous.
He won't be the only one.
It was taped.
Dr. Kiefer.
On the early show.
Yes,
your
please.
First patient is waiting.
Talk! Then comes the late show. The first one was the dress show. The second was the air show.
Doctor, if it's going to hurt, please give me something to kill the pain.
Yeah. Okay, well, got some Novocaine right here.
Tim and, then came up with the whole Novocaine thing.
Okay, Novocaine. Here we are, Novocaine. Take a firm hold of the hypodermic needle. Right.
Which Harvey had never seen.
There'll be a little bit of pain, and then numbness will set in.
And Tim started shooting himself with the Novocaine, and then finally destroying himself throughout the sketch.
Well, I guess we'll get right to it.
And poor Harvey was helpless. We've told this story, that Tim talks about it, that Harvey literally wet his pants. He was so mad at himself about laughing so hard, and you know.
Yeah, I'll be right with you.
I never wanted to break up. Harvey certainly didn't, because he was a consummate comedic actor. I didn't want to stop, because I wanted everybody to know that we were, in a sense, doing a live thing. There was a danger and a spontaneity that I think people they locked into.
Ear tugs don't make much noise.
Right.
So.
Oh, no, you don't want me to.
No. Do you still do the Tarzan yell?
Well, yeah, I can still do it. But it's one time I was at Bergdorf Goodman years and years ago, and I was buying some stockings, and it was I was late for rehearsal. It was around 10 in the morning, and the store had just opened. And so this sales lady was very sweet, and I mistakenly didn't bring my right credit card. And I said, oh, gee, I'm sorry, I don't have my card. Can I write you a check? And she said, oh, I'll need some identification. But she said, no, miss, I know who you are. She said, but let me ask the floor manager across the floor there. She was at the end of the room behind a very pretty desk. And she said, let me ask Miss Carlton. So she walked over to Miss Carlton, and then Miss Carlton kind of waved and smiled, and then the sales lady came back. And she said, Miss Carlton will approve your check if you'll do the Tarzan yell. So I said, now, it was empty, you know, right? And so I said, okay. So I did the Tarzan yell, and immediately behind the sales lady, there was an exit door. It burst open, and there was a security guard with a gun. So I only do the Tarzan yell when people expect it. You know?
I'm so glad we had this time together.
That's legendary comedian and actress Carol Burnett. Her new DVD collection from Time Life is called The Carol Burnett Show, The Ultimate Collection. It's out now. Carol Burnett, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for asking me. I really appreciate it. And it was nice talking to you. We have to say so long.
There's a time you put aside for dreaming, and a time for things you have to do. But the time I like the best is any evening. I can spend a moment here with you. When the time comes and I'm feeling lonely, and I'm feeling I just sit back and think of you, and the happiness still comes through. That's why. me feel that I belong. Seems we just get started, and before you know it, guess it's time for me to say so.
Colin Malloy is one of those musicians who has an obsessive fan base. He's the frontman for the influential indie band called The Decemberists. His songs tell stories, sometimes about real-life historical events and sometimes folklore. So it seemed like a natural progression for Malloy to write books, and he did. Last year, he and his wife Carson Ellis released an illustrated children's novel called Wildwood. It tells the story of a precocious seventh grader named Prue McKeel who lives in Portland. One day, Prue's baby brother is kidnapped by a flock of crows and deposited into the woods across the Willamette River. So she and her friend Curtis go into the forest, known as the Impassable Wilderness, to rescue him. And in the forest, they discover a world of talking animals, mystics, scoundrels, and bandits. In the sequel, called Under Wildwood, Curtis is still in the forest, but Prue is back in the seventh grade and bored to tears.
And her life is kind of returned to normal, but not quite.
But she wants to go back.
Yeah, well, I think anybody who had had that kind of adventure, I think, would be drawn back. I think that's what she realizes, how
she can't just sit in the seventh grade.
Yeah, her rest of her life is, compared to Curtis, who made the decision to stay.
He stayed behind, and his parents have no idea where he is, and that's why they go off. They set off to Turkey to go find him.
Yeah. Yeah, so and he's kind of enjoying his life, his new life in the woods, really unaware of the kind of havoc he's caused his family at home.
He basically decides to become a bandit. He is in bandit training.
Yes.
And there's a sort of a sub-story, which is that their parents leave his sisters behind, and they leave him at a very unusual place. So they go to Turkey, and they've got to find somebody to look after them. Tell me about what they do to Rachel and Elsie.
Right. Well, they drop them off at the orphanage, the Unthank Home for Wayward Youth, which is an orphanage in a machine parts factory. And actually, that was based on a real life thing. My dad one day was talking about remembering how his parents used to board him and his brothers and sisters at the local orphanage in Helena, Montana, whenever they went on family trips or
they really
go on
did
a
this.
Trip together. And it was something that you could do, apparently.
You could actually leave your kids at an orphanage at one
you
point.
You could board, yeah, huh. For a fee, you could board your kids at an orphanage.
Like a kennel for children.
I know. And I have to say, my grandparents were very loving and doting parents to my dad. But I think it was sort of an acceptable thing to do at the time.
I guess it was also a way to say, look, if you think you have it bad at home, just imagine what it's like in an orphanage, and then you would go and be in an orphanage.
And you would experience it, yeah. And my dad remembers having roommates, you know, who are actual orphans and feeling kind of weird about that.
You wrote this book with your wife, Carson Ellis. She did the illustrations. And you'd been talking about this for a long time. Were there parts of it that you thought, you know, this is just too dark for kids, and we're going to have to just cut this out?
Well, I feel like I tailored it all along, and I knew that I wanted to kind of push that and make it as dark as I could, just from the books that I loved growing up, John Bellairs and Roald Dahl, who I think really pushed the envelope of what dark material, not necessarily dark material that kids could handle, but mostly what publishers would publish, because I think kids can handle really dark material, and in fact, I think they really love it and long for it.
I'm speaking with Colin Malloy. He's best known as the frontman for the band The Decemberists, but he's also a novelist, and he's just released his second book. It's called Under Wildwood, and it's for young readers, and that's what we're discussing today. I know you have one child, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he is...
He's six.
Six.
Six and a half.
Did you guys read this to him?
Carson actually read it to him when it was finished. But on the last one, I had actually read the pages as I was writing them. I didn't do that this time. I feel like I was moving faster, but also felt more confident, I think, in my writing, that you know, I kind of needed to sit down with Carson and Hank there and read the pages to them just to make sure that they worked and they made sense. I think with this book, I was a lot more confident and didn't necessarily need that, my six-year-old's criticism.
Did she get any from him?
He always wants more space alien attacks in the books. I'm trying to figure out how to fit that in.
Did you find that he could grasp? I mean, some of this book is tough. I mean, it's pretty sophisticated stuff.
Yeah, my kid is a little different. I mean, he's autistic, and his fixation is books. Hmm. And he taught himself to read when he was 2.5. And while he has really a hard time maintaining relationships, talking to people, even holding a pencil, he has some severe delays. He has this remarkable ability in reading and comprehension, and I feel like he's constantly teaching us stuff.
I didn't know that about your son. Did his relationship with reading and books, did that play a big part in your decision to do this, to write this book?
I think it must have. Books became a much bigger part in our lives as soon as he was born and as soon as we realized what was going on, where all of a sudden we were taking nearly biweekly trips to the library to kind of satisfy his appetite for these books. And I think we discovered a lot of books that way. And, you know, it was a joy being able to dig out books that we loved as kids and rediscover them with him. So, yeah, I think it did play a big part in it.
Does he relate to those characters, to Prue and Curtis?
He does. Well, I think when I was writing Wildwood, I think a lot of the stuff that, because he was 4 at the time, I think a lot of it helped him kind of figure out just kind of opposing forces, this idea of differences between people, and he was sort of mystified by the differences in the bandits and the coyotes and really fixated on this idea that they should be friends. And so in many ways, I think that Prue and Curtis's adventures helped him kind of figure out relationships between kids, even though it's really difficult for him, and it will probably continue to be elusive to him. I hope in some way the way they work together and the way they work with the characters in the book will help him figure out relationships to a certain degree.
What do you think is next up for Prue and Curtis? Are we going to meet up with them again after this book?
Oh, absolutely. There is a third book in the works. I'm working on it right now. Yeah, the adventure continues.
That's Colin Malloy. He's the frontman for the band The Decemberists. His new book is called Under Wildwood. It's part of the Wildwood Chronicles series, and it's out now. Colin, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Guy. Thanks for having me on.
At the beginning of 1997, Nigel Godrich was a relatively unknown recording engineer. He was looking for a band that would trust his instincts as a producer. He finally got his chance with the band Radiohead and the album OK Computer. And by the end of 1997, Nigel Godrich would become one of the most talked about names in music. Radiohead's album became the biggest critical hit of that year, of the decade, some say. It set a new course for progressive rock music, one that Nigel Godrich would continue to shift at will. And soon enough, he became one of the most sought-after producers, working with the likes of Paul McCartney and Beck. Now, Nigel Godrich has taken another detour to center stage. He's formed a new three-piece band called Ultraista. Now, the name Ultraista gives some indication of the band's approach and its sound. The name comes from the Spanish literary movement known as Ultraísmo of the early 20th century. The poets and writers who were part of it, including Jorge Luis Borges, were committed to writing spare but evocative works.
My mother gave me a book by Luis Borges of his short stories. It had a big effect on me. It's very surrealist, very abstract. I was reading about him, and it talked about the altruist movement. It suggested color and vibration and extreme, so it just seemed very fitting.
Now, Nigel Godrich started the band with the well-known drummer Joey Warrenker, but they needed a singer. They decided not to trade on their influence in the industry, but rather to find someone unknown.
We spent a good deal of energy making little posters that we stuck around art schools in London for a random project.
You were actually advertising this?
Well, no, we just said, oh, you know, because the original intention, or my fantasy anyway, was just that maybe we would find somebody who wasn't a musician per se.
But it didn't have your name on it or anything.
No.
Nobody knew it was you.
Signed, no. Puff Daddy.
No luck with the posters, but they did find themselves an art student who happened to be attracting some attention of her own in London. Her name was Laura Bettinson.
Joey and I went to see Laura play in a pub, and she had her own solo project which involved her performing by chopping up her voice into little loops.
How many people were at the pub that night?
Well, I don't know, 50, 70 maybe?
Laura Bettinson had no idea that a Grammy Award-winning producer and a legendary session musician were in the audience scoping her out.
I was aware that their manager was coming down, but I didn't have any idea that the guys were coming down.
But were you nervous? Did you think, this is my shot?
No, not at all, really. Just because I didn't have anything to lose, so I didn't pretend to do anything that I wouldn't do normally. You know, if they don't like it, they don't like it.
But they did like it, and they brought her to a studio to lay down some of those cut-and-paste singing techniques over their own productions. And the result was this debut album, Ultraista. The first single is called Bad Insect. You know, it starts with this kind of high and low frequency percussion. And you get that, the bass tones coming in. And then we hear snippets, just looped snippets of Laura's voice. And then all of a sudden, just bam, we hear her sing that first line.
Beautifully said, though. I was I was with you.
I was
riding off into the sunset.
The lyrics are sometimes indecipherable, and when they aren't, they're still pretty hard to comprehend. To understand them, you have to reconsider the band's name, Ultraista. The Ultraists had a manifesto, and its very first rule, reduction of the lyric element to its primordial element, metaphor.
That is the way that the words were brought together in the cut and paste. You know, we sat and played word games with each other and talked about how it's as relevant today, probably more, than it was then.
Yeah.
It was about, you know, just throwing away stuff that's old and trying to make something new.
That's producer Nigel Godrich. His new band, Ultraista, just released its self-titled debut album. And this weekend only, you can stream every track for free at our website, nprmusic.org. For the week ending October 7th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. This week, the show was produced by Phil Harrell and directed by Brent Bachman and Kenya Young. Our production staff includes Lauren Silverman, Brenda Salinas, Peggy Hersher, and Amy Held, with help this week from Sarah Ventry. Our interns are Brenda Sprunt and Acacia Squires. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. And thanks for tuning in.